Hello there. Today is Monday, February 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, is the world now in an all-out nuclear arms race?
One side has not been adhering to it. We have, but one side hasn't. So unless they're going to adhere, we shouldn't be the only one.
President Trump is preparing for a shutdown, delayed State of the Union address Tuesday. Sudan's new president plans to reopen the country's border with Eritrea. And making workspaces for women in male-dominated jobs. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States and Russia are making tit-for-tat moves with their participation in a nuclear treaty, something politicians and analysts see as a burgeoning arms race. Russian President Vladimir Putin announced Saturday that Russia is suspending its participation in the Cold War era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. It follows a similar action Friday by the U.S. In a statement Friday, President Donald Trump announced the U.S. is suspending its compliance with the decades-old treaty and accused the Kremlin of willfully breaking the deal.
You have a certain side that almost pretends it doesn't exist, pretty much pretends it doesn't exist. So unless we're going to have something that we all agree to, we can't be put at the disadvantage of going by a treaty, limiting what we do when somebody else doesn't go by that treaty.
Putin said Russia will start work on creating new missiles, including hypersonic ones. He told his foreign and defense ministers not to initiate disarmament talks with Washington. In response to all of these actions, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said NATO will continue discussions with Russia.
This is a very serious issue, and we need to make sure that we respond as an alliance, all 29 allies, because all allies are involved and all allies are affected.
Joining us to discuss the implications is Joseph Cirincione, a nuclear weapons policy expert and the president of the Global Security Foundation Plowshares Fund. Thank you for being with us. The president says Russia is in violation of this nuclear treaty.
Russia is almost certainly in violation of the treaty. They tested a ground-launched cruise missile at a range beyond what is permitted by the treaty. And despite 3 years now of trying to get them to fess up to this violation, they have stonewalled until very recently when they've offered inspections of the missile. The U.S. has declined those inspections. The U.S. is taking a very hard line, insisting that they destroy the missiles, which Russia refuses to do. So we're deadlocked right now.
How important is this treaty in your view, not just for the U.S., but really the entire world?
Historically, this was a very important treaty. When Ronald Reagan negotiated it back in 1987, it was the first treaty ever to not just limit nuclear weapons, but to cut them, to reduce them. The Soviet Union and the United States destroyed over about 2,700 perfectly good nuclear weapons that they had spent billions of dollars and many years building. And that began the process of nuclear reductions that went on for over 30 years until the current administration. What it does is prohibit a very destabilizing kind of weapon just in Europe. Well, globally, for both the United States and Russia, its target is Europe. These are missiles that can be launched on very short notice and have very short flight time. So for the enemy could launch these weapons, and the first you'd know about it would be mushroom clouds in your cities. So it's helped stabilize the situation. The danger now is that, one, without this treaty, Russia has no limits on what it can do. It could now deploy hundreds of weapons if it wanted to. The U.S. might try to match it in kind, and that could reignite not just tensions, but splits in the NATO alliance. It's hard to imagine any of our NATO allies welcoming U.S. deployment of new ballistic or cruise missiles on their territory.
Right. And of course, as you mentioned, we've got China, we've got India, they're nuclear armed countries. Is this sending them a message loud and clear?
It's telling them that the arms race is off and running, that Russia is building new weapons, the U.S. wants to build new weapons. Part of the U.S. announcement in recent days wasn't just that it was suspending implementation of this treaty, but it was now going to start research and development on similar weapons. So if the U.S. and Russia are now doing this, well, why shouldn't China and mm-hmm. India and Pakistan and Iran build these kinds of weapons? It's pouring gasoline on what was already a fiery arms race.
You're saying we are literally heading right toward a nuclear arms race?
We are in a nuclear arms race. Every single nuclear armed country is building new nuclear weapons. There are 9 countries. Some of them are adding to their arsenals, like India, Pakistan, and China, North Korea, and some are replacing Cold War weapons. The U.S. and Russia have about 93% of all the nuclear weapons in the world, and their arsenals had been capped. Taking this treaty away now removes the cap on one type of missile, and the fear is that the administration, particularly John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, wants to go after the one last remaining limitation treaty, the New START treaty. Again, mm-hmm. a Ronald Reagan treaty that was started back in the 80s, that controls long-range ballistic missiles. If that goes, and the treaty is set to expire in 2021, then for the first time since 1972, there won't be any limits on U.S. and Russian weapons. That is an arms race.
This administration has been pulling out of international treaties since he came into office.
Well, this is also what worries the Europeans. This is part of a pattern. They've seen the Trump administration pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Iran anti-nuclear deal, and now this. So it makes the Europeans question America's commitment to their security and to the global nuclear safety net and security nets that have been established over the last 30 years. When the president says America first, a lot of Europeans here go it alone.
That is Joseph Cirincione, a nuclear weapons policy expert and president of the Global Security Foundation, Plowshares Fund. On Tuesday, U.S. President Donald Trump is scheduled to give his second State of the Union speech after a brutal fight with lawmakers over border wall funding, which triggered the largest partial government shutdown in American history. Against this backdrop, Trump will address a new Congress with a record number of younger members, minorities and women. The president will also have to contend with Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to avoid another government shutdown in less than 2 weeks. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has more from the White House.
Baker, the President of the United States.
On Tuesday, Donald Trump will again step into the House of Representatives chamber.
The state of our union is strong.
This year's State of the Union address follows a brutal fight with Democratic lawmakers over border wall funding, which triggered the longest partial government shutdown in history. The shutdown pushed back the date of the annual speech.
His entire goal, right, with the State of the Union is going to be to try to reconvince his base that he is, in fact, strong, and that he is not, in fact, weak, that he didn't, in fact, lose, that that's been a, you know, fake news meme that he needs to correct.
The White House says this year's theme is Choosing Greatness, where the president will discuss immigration, trade deals, infrastructure, health care, and efforts to stop foreign wars, and that the tone will be unifying and optimistic. But experts predict there will be fewer calls for unity and more of this.
I'm the one that's trying to help you. They're the ones that are trying to block what I'm doing.
Last year, behind the president sat Paul Ryan, then House Speaker from his own Republican Party.
Thank you.
This year, Nancy Pelosi will be holding the gavel, a reminder that the 2018 elections gave the House majority to Democrats with record number of younger members, minorities, and women in Congress. In 2018, many women Democrats wore black to support the Me Too campaign against sexual harassment and assault. This year, a Democratic House group invited female lawmakers to wear white to mark the suffragette movement, which led to a women's right to vote in 1920.
To him, all of the women sitting out there wearing white is just a big statement of opposition, and the fact that half of the room definitely will not be standing up or clapping or cheering at anything he says. I think those things get under his skin.
Two more women in this political theater. Victorina Morales, the undocumented worker who was fired from one of Trump's golf resorts, will be the guest of a Democratic lawmaker. And Stacey Abrams, an African-American who garnered national attention in her unsuccessful bid to become governor of Georgia, will deliver the Democratic response, a signal of her party's focus on diversity and concern about the election system.
Do we have a system that makes the Voting Rights Act come to life, or do we have a system in which voters are suppressed in particular regions?
On Friday, the president again hinted he may declare a national emergency to bypass Congress for for wall funding.
Well, I'm saying listen closely to the State of the Union. I think you'll find it very exciting.
And if last year's 80-minute speech was any indication, it could be another long address. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump won't rule out another government shutdown in the border wall dispute. U.S. and South Korean diplomats will meet ahead of a Trump-Kim summit. Salvadorians cast their vote for a new president. And Pope Francis is in Abu Dhabi for an interfaith conference. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Well, Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir declared in recent days that he is reopening Sudan's border with Eritrea, which has been closed due to political friction for nearly a year. Bashir also acknowledged that the country's six-week-old protest movement has put him under serious pressure. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
As protesters demonstrated in parts of the Sudanese capital of Khartoum on Thursday, President Omar al-Bashir visited the northeastern state of Kassala, announcing that the border between neighboring Eritrea and Sudan would be reopened after a year of closure. He says that he greets the people of Eritrea and its president, and he proclaims that the border between the two countries is now open because they are our dear brethren, despite the fact that politics has caused division among us. He went on to tell supporters that it was the duty of the government to have a dialogue with young people and that the government must educate them and provide for their needs. He insisted, however, that any political change will only take place through elections. He says that there will be no change of government or of the president via Facebook or WhatsApp, and vows that change will only take place at the ballot box. Sudan's Association of Trade Unions called for another day of protest against the government Thursday, prompting a number of demonstrations in Khartoum and other parts of the country. The group's spokesman, Mohamed Asbat, told Al Hora TV that the government's appeal for dialogue with young people and the release of prisoners is not sincere. Asbat says that the government's message that it is releasing prisoners and undertaking dialogue is intended for the consumption of outside countries who have been warning it not to arrest peaceful protesters and to release them. Opposition leader Miriam Sadiq al-Mahdi, who was briefly detained by Sudanese security forces Wednesday, told Al Hora TV that the government's efforts at dialogue have failed and that in the face of a growing revolution, it has resorted to arresting young people. She says that President Bashir's round of visits to far-flung provinces does not reflect any desire on the part part of the Sudanese people, that he remain in power, and that it is normal for dictators to draw their supporters around them to make it look like they are popular. Sudan's intelligence chief, General Salah Ghosh, has met with a number of young protesters who have been jailed for taking part in demonstrations, but opposition leaders say that he and the government have released very few prisoners out of the several thousand they say are being detained. Ghosh insisted in a speech to military cadets that outside forces are trying to create chaos inside the country. He says that there are forces trying to create chaos in the country and cause economic hardship for its people, but that the security forces will combat them with force and determination and restore order. Al Arabiya TV reports that Ghosh asserted that leftist parties are trying to overthrow the government and stated that a number of armies or militia groups are waiting for Khartoum to be engulfed in chaos in order to march on the capital and seize power. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
One of the important aspects of gauging the damage being done to the world's ecosystems by climate change is knowing the current status of those systems. So a British-based charity is about to embark on an expedition to gauge the health of one of the world's few remaining pristine reefs. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
According to the nonprofit Coral Guardian, coral reefs host about 25% of all the ocean's biodiversity. They also serve as a natural barrier to protect shorelines from punishing storms and waves. But we're losing them.
We've seen mass coral bleaching taking place with an increasing frequency and increasing severity. We're seeing all sorts of other impacts on marine life. And that's now. If we allowed the temperature to rise to 2 degrees, then we can pretty much wave goodbye to coral reef ecosystems. And indeed, we will probably lose many other types of marine habitat and many species as well.
Experts say the problem is warming waters, due in part to human activities that contribute to overall climate change.
We've seen a global movement of marine life in order to try and track the temperatures that organisms like to live in. They're moving to the north or to the south, away from the equator.
To better understand what's happening to our reefs, the British nonprofit Necton is about to head to the Seychelles off the coast of Africa to assess these mostly healthy reefs. The team will make a series of dives on board the submersible to better understand what's going on in these reefs.
It's really vital that we go literally out there and see, for example, how our coral reefs are affected by all these CO2 emissions, and which causes acidification and essentially causes the destruction of coral reefs.
The mission will allow the team to understand not only shallow reefs, but also the deeper reefs that are still something of a mystery.
So it would be really interesting to go out there and actually see, in Seychelles in particular, which is one of the places which is relatively pristine still, to see if the effects of climate change are actually evident on the shallow coral reefs, and especially on the deeper reefs that so far no one looked before.
Alex Rogers, an Oxford professor working with Necton, says the information is vital, because saving the coral reefs and combating climate change is something the world has to tackle.
We have to make a decision whether we go down a pathway of behaving responsibly, or we can continue on the pathway which we're currently on, in which case we're going to see probably a geological scale extinction in the ocean. And it's as simple as that.
The 7-week expedition begins in March. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
On our your voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, more than 700 people have been sickened with Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and of those, more than 400 have died. And while neighboring countries of South Sudan and Rwanda are bracing for the virus to spread, a world away in the U.S., researchers are racing to develop a new, long-lasting vaccine against the virus. VOA's Carol Pearson has details.
In Congo, Ebola claims the lives of 60% of those who get the virus. The disease is so feared that even those who survive it are shunned.
What really makes it frightening is the high mortality rate, the very severe symptoms that people experience, and, you know, the fact that it comes up when not expected.
Dr. Paul Spearman is the lead investigator of a clinical trial that's testing two experimental Ebola vaccines at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center in Ohio.
We're giving one vaccine and followed 1 week later by another vaccine, and that could give you very rapid protection.
If this vaccine combination proves effective, it could be used in African countries wherever Ebola breaks out.
These epidemics that occur in several parts of Africa can arise without warning.
The vaccines don't contain the Ebola virus, but they produce a major Ebola virus protein that's designed to get the immune system to react. The study participants are all volunteers. Like Christy Keller, they're aware of the health and humanitarian crisis Ebola causes.
With research, through research, to stop it or prevent it or make it so that it's not something that grows rapidly or spreads rapidly, then I think being a part of something like that is worth it.
In the laboratories at Cincinnati Children's, researchers test the volunteers' blood samples, which are collected before getting injected with the experimental vaccines and also afterwards. The goal is to produce a vaccine that is both effective and long-lasting and safe. Carnell Singh leads the sample testing in his lab at Cincinnati Children's.
We have baseline after 1 week, after 2 weeks, and we compare the three and then see what difference vaccination makes.
Another vaccine is being used in the outbreak in Congo, developing effective vaccines that protect against Ebola for a long time is a top global public health priority. The researchers in Cincinnati hope their work will improve the understanding of how to build immunity to other viruses or bacteria that can cause disease. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Well, a prominent Kenyan newspaper reports that top officials may have imperiled key strategic assets when it signed a 2014 contract deal with China for the country's standard gauge railway. Salem Solomon has the story.
As it winds through Kenya's lush national parks, the standard gauge railway, the country's largest infrastructure project since independence, seems like a symbol of progress. Some experts argue the railway will support Kenya's long-term development.
The standard gauge railway is a real game changer. And now you have a railway where you can get on a train and you can arrive at the other end in 5 hours.
The railway connects Nairobi and Mombasa, Kenya's two largest cities. Before the SGR, it took 10 to 15 hours to drive between the cities on a stretch of poor roads.
That is completely game changing for people movement, but I think perhaps more importantly for goods movement.
But a new report by the Daily Nation, Kenya's largest independent newspaper, suggests a hidden cost. It claims the multi-billion dollar loan with China to build the railway could imperil Kenya's sovereignty and assets. Details of the 2014 contract between Kenya and the Export-Import Bank of China emerged in early January. Beijing's infrastructure deals and the structure of its loans are typically kept secret. The Nation report says it obtained a copy of the pact and raised concerns on the scope of assets Kenya must forfeit if it defaults on the loan. The contract also stipulates that Kenya must use Chinese goods, technology and services in the railway's construction and operation. A confidentiality clause prohibits the Kenyan government from disclosing the terms of the contract without Beijing's expressed written consent. The excerpts provide some of the most tangible evidence to date that Beijing may engage in what critics characterize as debt-trap diplomacy, lending designed to force countries into handing over land, minerals, and strategic assets when they default on a loan. The nation didn't reveal how it acquired the contract nor how it determined its authenticity. But language in the document closely matches contracts VOA reviewed for projects tied to the Belt and Road Initiative, China's trillion-dollar global infrastructure plan in Serbia, Kyrgyzstan, and Guyana. These contracts suggest the terms of the Kenya loan may reflect Beijing's lending practices across Africa and beyond. Since launching in 2017, the SGR has been marred by allegations of corruption, racism, and poor management. Both Kenyan and Chinese officials have faced criminal charges. President Uhuru Kenyatta pushed back against claims that Chinese lending has hurt the country.
My friends, we are ahead of our payment schedule. We are not tied to any country, but we are working together with those who appreciate and understand Kenya's developmental needs, China being one of them. China is a very, very strong supporter of Kenya's development agenda.
He added that Kenya will continue to borrow for development. I'm Salim Solomon for VOA News, Washington.
Well, there wasn't much change on the movie charts this weekend as another form of entertainment grabbed people's attention. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
This Super Bowl weekend, a lot of people stayed out of the cold and away from theaters, making for the worst box office numbers in nearly two decades.
The three of you have convinced yourselves you have extraordinary gifts, like something out of a comic book.
But no superhero numbers for Glass. According to Studio Estimate Sunday, it holds on to number one with just $9.5 million in ticket sales, followed closely by The Upside with $8.9 million.
La Bala.
Gina Rodriguez, the star of TV's Jane the Virgin, got good reviews for her first big movie role, but the movie itself, Miss Bala, was generally panned.
The bullet settles everything.
It debuted in third with a meager $6.7 million. I'm Ben Thomas.
And finally today, 40 years ago today, the popular American rock megastar band Fleetwood Mac released their album Rumors, which became one of the most successful albums of the era. The record included mega hits like Go Your Own Way, Dreams, and You Make Loving Fun. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. You can go your own way.
This is VOA News.